March 2nd, 1962. Sports history was made at Hershey Sports Arena. There is no film to document the story I'm about to tell you. The Philadelphia Warriors defeated the New York Knicks that evening, 169-147. There were five NBA records set that night that have not been broken since. Most of those by Wilt Chamberlain, who was playing for the Philadelphia Warriors. The two that are significant are this. Wilt Chamberlain became the only basketball player in American history to score over 100 personal points that night. One man scored over 100 points for his team. That's the only time that's ever happened. But along with that, and almost as important, is that Wilt Chamberlain also set a record for the most free throws made in one game. Now, what's significant about that is, typically, a player that's hot shooting is going to be fouled because he's unlikely to make foul shots. But on this particular night and in this particular season, every attempt to foul Chamberlain only resulted in more points being scored. He made 28 free throws. 28 points from the free throw line. On that night, he only missed four. Out of 32 shots, Chamberlain scored 28. Wilt Chamberlain was in his third season with the NBA, playing for the Warriors. You need to know that in his first season with the team, his free throw percentage was 50%. So on this night, if he were scoring from the free throw line like he had scored the prior two seasons, he would have only made 16 points. And he would not have broken the 100-point record. In his lifetime, Wilt Chamberlain missed over 5,000 free throws. Now add that up. That's a lot of points in a basketball game. 5,000 points that he did not make. But in this third season, Wilt Chamberlain was shooting better than he had ever shot before. Why? One of the all-time free throw shooters is a man named Rick Barry. And some of you have recently seen him in New York Life commercials. The commercial's theme is all about consistency. New York Life picked Rick Barry because he had one of the most consistent free throws in NBA history. He is the third ranked all-time free throw shooter in the history of that game, and in the ABA, a defunct league now, he was the top free throw shooter. Let me tell you why. If you know anything about basketball, most men come to the line, dribble the ball, raise their hands above their head, and shoot with one hand, trying to put backspin on the ball so that it will either hit the net and drop in, hit the rim and drop in, or the backboard and drop in. Rick Barry shoots different. Rick Barry approaches the free throw line, puts his toes together on that line, bends his knees slightly to takes the ball in his hands, between his legs, and tosses it. He gets a natural backspin. The ball floats into the net, and he's the third highest scoring free throw shooter in NBA history. If you've seen the commercial, there is a film that does not stop that shows Rick Barry shooting a free throw blindfolded and making it. He hit 90% of all his free throws in his NBA career. That means every time you fouled Rick Barry, he went to the line with what's called the granny shot. And out of 10 tosses, 9 of them went in. You didn't want to foul Rick Barry. Wilt Chamberlain, a 50% free throw shooter. He looked good, but he only dropped 1 out of 2. In the third year of his career, adopted the granny style free throw. That year, he shot from between his legs, and his free throw percentage soared to 80% plus. But on that night in March 1962, he was unsurpassed. The most free throws ever made by an NBA player in NBA history. 28 out of 32. The next year, Wilt Chamberlain returned to his former shooting style. And his percentage dropped back to the usual 50%. And why would he do that? We'll answer that question near the end of this lesson. I'm really glad to be back with you here. It hasn't been very long since we were together, and I'm really happy to be talking to you young people, because I'll tell you something I think you need in your life. I think you need a challenge. Adam and I have talked about this before we came here, and I think you need to know what it really means to follow Jesus. I think you need to know that the songs we just sang, as beautiful and happy sounding as they are, may leave a wrong impression with you about what it means to be a Christian and a follower of Jesus Christ. So we're going to shuck the corn and pull out the silks and come right down to the cob of what it means to be a follower of Jesus. I want to talk to you in two lessons about Jesus' own call, what he calls us to. But then I think it's equally important, not just that we hear what Jesus is asking of us, but that we see people in the scriptures, even in the Old Testament, who manifested that kind of devotion and discipleship to God. And Adam's going to talk about a couple of those, Lord allowing us to be together. I think it's important to hear both those, the ideal and then how it's practically put into the lives of others. And then I want to say this. There are a lot of adults here, and I'm telling you, the things that we're talking about are just as important for you to hear as it is for these young people to hear this. There's a phrase we hear. Somebody will say, He thinks she's in love with him. And somebody else will say, he's living in denial. Or she thinks she's beautiful. And someone says, she's living in denial. What do we mean by that phrase? The phrase is typically used of us to describe someone who's attempting to escape a difficult situation by ignoring its existence. I want you to see how Jesus used the idea of living in denial. Let's talk about what it really means to walk in the steps of the Savior. When you turn to the gospel accounts and you go to the very first one, not because Matthew's first in being written, but Matthew brings us to chapter 5. Jesus has been baptized by John and he's gone into the wilderness and been tempted of the devil. And in chapter 5, he comes back into the environs of those cities of Galilee and Nazareth. And in verse 18, in chapter 4, verse 18, as Jesus was walking by the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon, who was called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And he said to them, "Follow me, and I'll make you fishers of men." And immediately they left their nets and followed him. And going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, in the boat with Zebedee, their father, mending their nets. And he called them. And immediately they left the boat and their father and followed him. Jesus' call is to follow him. Matthew records that invitation or command 7 times. Mark, 4 times. Luke, 5 times. John, 7 times. John alone says, Jesus said, "Follow me. Follow me, follow me, follow me, follow me, follow me, follow me." And that's in John's account alone. Now, I want to suggest to you, that's a really strong demand. It's a stronger demand than some other things Jesus might have said. So think with me, and you're welcome if you'd like to, young people, to even answer aloud. What's the difference in saying, "Follow me and listen to me"? Any thoughts? Does one of those seem stronger to you than the other? Seem more demanding than the other? Follow me versus listen to me? Or watch me? Or come with me? And I want to suggest to you that it is a stronger command. Because when Jesus says, "Follow me," it implies that we're walking after him. We're not just learning from him. It's not just listen to me and learn what I know. It is come with me, behind me. And that is so exemplified in that statement in Matthew chapter 4. Because it says, immediately the disciples did what? First words, left their nets. What were they doing? They were giving up their life and adopting his life. When he says, "Follow me and I will make you fishers of men," he is necessarily saying, "And you will quit being fishers of fish." You and I, when we're called to follow Jesus, are called to a far more intimate situation than "watch me." The other day, I had to change a brake light bulb in my wife's car. It had gone bad. I wasn't sure how to do that. So what did I do? I got on YouTube. I looked up 2011 Toyota Highlander changing brake bulb. And I watched a guy change that bulb. And I did what he did. But I don't know that guy. I don't have a relationship with him. We haven't started exchanging Christmas cards or birthday messages or anything like that. I'm grateful for what he did, but I don't have a relationship with him. I'm not following him. I followed what he said do, but I'm not following him. I haven't picked up, moved to where he is, and watch him in the morning and go wherever it is he works. or hold the camera while he makes more YouTube videos. I haven't done any of those things. I'm going to tell you something. When you follow Jesus, you're not just showing up at church to hear a message about him and go home. When he says, follow me, he's telling you to do something more than what I did with the guy on the YouTube video. He was helpful. I learned something from him. I'm grateful for what he did. It made a difference in my life. Small, but a difference. But it ends. Turn the video off and we're done. But you can't do that with Jesus. Jesus didn't say, watch my YouTube videos. Give me some likes. He didn't say that. He didn't say, follow me on Facebook. He didn't say, do that. You know, we follow people on Facebook. In some ways, that's kind of creepy, you know? I just want to see where they ate tonight, when their birthday is. Send them a bunch of likes for things that are going on. But you don't have a relationship with them. You're not changed in your life by following them on Facebook. So I want you to understand that the things we sang tonight are probably far more serious than the way you sang them. Trying to walk in the steps of the Savior. Following Jesus. Where he leads, I will follow. Who will follow Jesus? We're not talking about just looking at what he said. When he said, follow me, he didn't say, just listen to me, watch me. He didn't say, come with me. He said, come behind me. Go where I go. It demands that the one we're following be more advanced in that walk than we are. He's not saying, come alongside me and we'll figure this out together. When we follow Jesus, we're acknowledging he has knowledge and experience we don't have. And power to walk where our power is weak. On a few occasions, Jesus used this phrase, come after me. And the one who would come after me. And you may think that is just a positional statement. Like a teacher would say, children, line up behind me. Walk behind me. But when Jesus said, come after me, he's using the same kind of terminology that we read in a couple of passages in the Old Testament that indicate that it's more than just a positional statement. It's a statement of the position of the heart. Listen to me. When we talk about following Jesus, it's not just trying to find out where his steps are. It is also something we pursue with passion. That phrase is often used in both the Greek and the Hebrew of two experiences you'll readily relate to. One is hunting and the other is romance. I might say to my wife, where are you going this morning? She says, I'm going shopping. Where are you going? I'm after a purse. Now, I don't picture that purse is running from her. But I understand she's in hunting mode. She's going to search for a particular kind of thing and she is after it. And she has a passion about it. It won't be a purse that she will stumble across. Oh, I wasn't thinking about a purse today, but there's a nice one and it's a good price. I'll buy it. She's done that. But when she says, I'm after it, she's a huntress. The second way we use that is a romance. In the deep south of Mississippi where I used to preach, I would hear young men say, and they would use this expression. They'd say, I kind of like that girl. I said, do you? They'd say, yeah, I'm studying her. It was an interesting expression. Studying her?
Well, they have a class in that or something? Well, what he meant was, I'm trying to find out more about her. What he really is saying is, I'm after her. I'm on her trail. And that's not meant to be a creepy statement. That's meant to be, I'm interested in her. In Psalm 63 in verse 8, it's one of my favorite psalms. There's a great song written about that called Better Than Life. In verse 6 and 7, he says, when I remember you on my bed, Psalm 63, I meditate on you in the night watches. For you have been my help, and in the shadow of your wings I sing for joy. My soul clings to you. Other versions have given a different understanding of that. Other versions have said, my soul longs for you. Longs for you. Our church building is located right around the corner from a Krispy Kreme donut shop. And every time we leave Wednesday night services and drive and make the right-hand turn onto Kennedy Boulevard, a sign is lit up. It's red neon and it says, hot donuts now. And even when I wasn't thinking about hot donuts, my car was. And I fight the wheel, but it's more powerful than I am. And I'm in the drive-thru before I know it. But sometimes we get in the car, and before we've even started down the road and before we've even seen the sign, my good wife says, let's go to Krispy Kreme. And I know then why I married her. That's longing for it. You see, that's thinking about it ahead of time. That's not an afterthought. Jesus cannot be your afterthought. He will not be your afterthought. He wants you to long for him. You say, well, yeah, but the version you just read said, clings to you, my soul clings to you. Yeah, it's the idea of clutching the feet of Jesus as he drags us along. We will not be deterred from being in his presence. Jesus said, follow me. Come after me. Again, just one more example. In the book of Hosea, chapter 6 and verse 3. Hosea says, so let us know. Let us, listen to this, press on to know the Lord. Now, did you hear that phrase? Let us press on to know the Lord. That's the phrase. Let us come after the Lord. Press to know him. It's not a casual thing. It is an intentional thing, and it is the ultimate desire of one's heart. Jesus says, follow me. That's no small thing. Because what Jesus calls you to is living in denial. He has called you to live in denial. Now I have to wonder about this. What kind of sales tactic is that? For nearly 20 years, I was a public relations director. I read all the time, marketing and PR materials. I was constantly trying to think, how do people get encouraged to do the things they do? Why does that hot donuts now sign work the way it works? What kinds of sales tactics work? And here's what basically most of our culture sales tactics tell us.
Here's what you want. And here's how you can get it. And here's the good thing that it will mean for you when you get it. It's easy. And it's good. And you'll be better for it. Now contrast that for a moment with Jesus' call. Because contrary to the way many preachers today paint the call of Jesus, what he basically says is, give up everything, including your will, and follow mine. You don't believe that? Look at two of his greatest salesmen. 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 1. Peter calls himself what? A bond servant of the Lord. And Paul, Romans chapter 1, verse 1, bond servant of the Lord. Listen, there's nothing glorious about that. There's nothing fancy about that. A bond servant is just what it says it is. It is a servant bound to service, held in service to the Lord. Now, let me show you one more example of that and talk with you for just a moment about this. I'm in Deuteronomy 15. If you can join me there for a moment. Deuteronomy 15, I'm looking at verses 16 and 17. Deuteronomy 15, verses 16 and 17. Beginning in verse 12, and I'm just going to run this through. Moses gives some instruction to his people saying, if you've got a kinsman that serves you because he owes you something, you're to set him free. And the reason said in verse 15, because you'll remember you were a slave in the land of Egypt. And the Lord redeemed you, and therefore I command you this today. What he says is, you know what it was like to be a slave. That's no fun for you, but I set you free. So you need to set your servants, bond servants and slaves free. But now listen to this. If it comes about, if he says to you, I will not go out from you because he loves you and your household, since he fares well with you, then you shall take an awl and pierce it through his ear into the door. And he'll be your servant forever. And you'll do likewise to your maidservant. Do you hear that? Here's what he says. If you have a servant who is a slave in your household, who does not have the opportunity really to go free because they've earned it, but it's time for you to set him free because you remember you were slaves and you didn't like it. So when you go to that servant, male or female, and you say, I'm setting you free. You go do whatever you want to do. Go back to your life. Go do what you want to do. If the servant says, nope, I want to stay here. I want to continue serving you all my life. Then he says, you're to go to the doorpost of your house. I want you to picture this. You're going to take him to the doorpost, take an awl. Not oil, O-I-L, an awl, A-W-L. It's a punching device with a pointed end, like a large spike or a nail. Take that, and you're going to place his lobe of his ear against that doorpost, hold it out there, and drive the awl through his earlobe into the door. And you say, well, of course he'll be your slave forever. He's pinned there. No. He'll take that out. But he'll carry that mark the rest of his life or her life. What would make a servant who has the opportunity to go free make that decision? Do you ever think about that? Why would a slave volunteer to remain a slave? And the answer is love and provision trumps freedom and self-determination. Because the slave doesn't get to determine what they do. Now, once he's done that or she's done that, they can't say next week, I think I'm leaving. They've assigned themselves to your house for life. Why would you do that? Because of the love of this family for me and because they provide for me. And that's more important than my liberty or my self-determination to do whatever I want to do with my life. Now, you may argue with that, but that obviously was real. So let's take this slogan of self-denial and compare it to some of the slogans that we hear. These are the most popular slogans for products from the Advertising Hall of Fame. I'll give you the slogan. You're welcome to call it out loud, what the product is, or just think about it and I'll give it to you. You're in good hands with Allstate. Don't leave home without it. What's the product? American Express. Don't leave home without it. The ultimate driving machine. Mm-mm. BMW. The happiest place on earth. Oh, listen, all y'all. Oh. It's Disney. The quicker picker upper. What was it? Huh? Swiffer, no. Bounty. 15 minutes can save you money. Geico. When you care enough to send the very best. Hallmark. By the way, that's been their slogan since 1934. I love this one. This is one of my favorites. I'll be surprised if you get it. We answer to a higher authority. Oh, who said that? Who said that? Hebrew National Hot Dogs. That's right. They're kosher hot dogs. Kosher hot dogs. We answer to a higher authority, they say. When it absolutely, positively has to be there overnight. Mm-mm. FedEx. Sometimes you feel like a nut. Sometimes you don't. Peter Paul. What's in your wallet? Capital One. Is it in you? Gatorade. Melts in your mouth, not in your hand. M&Ms. And this one everybody's going to get. Just do it. Nike. Now what do those have in common? Think about this. What do they have in common? They give you advantage. They give you edge. They give you comfort. They give you prestige. They give you success. All those. That's what they're all telling you. Now contrast that. Listen. I'm telling you what Jesus said. Live in denial. It is not like any of those messages. And when we sugarcoat the call of Jesus to follow him, we take away from the level of commitment he is calling us to. Because here's the third point. Here's what he's really telling us to do. Jesus says, come die. Come die. The icon of Christianity is not a dove. It's not a rainbow. It's not a shepherd's staff. The most recognizable icon for Christianity is the symbol of that call. It is the cross. And listen, isn't that what Jesus says? In Luke chapter 9, And verse 23. Luke chapter 9 and verse 23. He was saying to them all, if anyone wishes to, here's that phrase, come after me. You want to cling to me? You want to come hunt me? You want a romantic relationship with me where your heart is given to me? If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, live in denial, and take up his cross daily and follow me. And follow me. Come die. Now listen, I know I'm saying this to you, and some of you are thinking, man, that's an awfully harsh call. That's calling us to do a lot more than I ever thought. I thought it would be, Jesus loves me. The Bible tells me that, and I get to live in that love. I'm going to come and hug him. And Jesus says, come climb up on the cross with me. There is nothing beautiful or heroic or noble about dying on a cross. It is a humiliating death. When the Romans executed people on crosses, they stripped them of their clothing. It was a long death. It was not short. It was a slow death. It was stripped of all dignity. He has called us to die a suffering death. In Philippians chapter 1, verse 29. Philippians chapter 1, verse 29. The Apostle Paul says, for to you, listen to this wording, would you? Listen. For to you it has been granted for Christ's sake, not only to believe in him. Oh, I'd like that part. But listen, it has been granted to you to also suffer for his sake. Suffer for his sake. Experiencing the same conflict which you saw in me, and now here to be in me. I mean, to me, that's like I'm going to a car dealership, and I say to the guy, I kind of like this car. He says, I'm going to make a good deal on this. I'm going to cut the price of the car by $2,000 for you. And I said, wow, that's really nice. He said, yeah, I'm going to tell you what else I'm going to do. I'm going to make sure that the seats that are in this car are taken out, and we're just going to have bare springs. And you're going to sit on those. Every time you get in the car, you're going to suffer. How about that? Good? You like that? Jesus says, through the Apostle Paul, I'm going to grant not only that you can believe, but I am going to grant that you get to suffer. Suffer with me. In 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 12. Paul's not the only one that says that. 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 12. Indeed, all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. Persecuted. Yeah, I don't care how you say that word. I don't care how you pronounce it. It's a dreadful word. All who desire to live godly will be persecuted. And in Luke chapter 6 and verse 22, Jesus said, blessed are you when men hate you, ostracize you, insult you, scorn your name as evil for the sake of the Son of Man. Listen, young people, when you go to school, I know I was there, and I probably felt the same way you probably would feel if this happens to you. But you go to school and somebody says, "You a Christian? Are you a believer?" You say, "I can't go with you. I'm going to be at church. I've got to be with my people and with the saints and with my Lord." And they make fun of you. They laugh about that. How do you feel about that? Do you walk away from that saying, "I feel so good. Give me more of that"? And listen, congregation, listen, church. If one of those young people comes, let's say one of those young people comes tonight and says, "I've been persecuted like that. They've called me names. They slapped my books out of my hand. They stomped on my Bible when I brought it one time. That's what they've done to me." And they come forward, "I need prayers." How many of us are going to react this way? "Oh, that's so terrible. I am so sorry that that happens. People shouldn't be that way. They're so evil and it shouldn't happen to you. You're too nice a person, too good a person for that to happen." Who is going to stand up and say, "You are blessed. Blessed." And how many of you are going to feel that way? "I'm blessed because I was able to be persecuted for the name of my Lord." Because that's what Jesus called us to. That's the level of commitment He is demanding of us. Die daily. Every day, every day, you got to put to death your life. Let's bring some things to a close. Remember Wilt Chamberlain? 50%80% year 4. I think I'll go back to 50%. And he does. Why? Why would he do that? Why would he go back to an inferior way of shooting when the goal of basketball is to score points? Here's what he said. "I just felt silly shooting that way." I just felt silly shooting that way. Rick Barry, who coached Wilt Chamberlain to the 80%+ and himself was a 90% free throw shooter, who's long retired from professional basketball now, coached his son, who's played at the University of Florida. Canyon finally agreed to shoot underhand, granny style. He is the second leading scorer in the University of Florida history and has set a record for 39 consecutive free throws. You want to foul him? On the other hand, Shaquille O'Neal, with a lifetime percentage of free throws of 52%. Lifetime 52%. One out of every two shots drops out of the basket. Was approached by Rick Barry about learning to shoot underhand. You know what he said? Listen to this. Listen, young people. "I'd rather shoot 0%. Too cool for that. Too cool for that. If the game is about scoring points, he's missed the purpose of the game." What Rick Barry has, and this is really important to you, what Rick Barry has that Wilt Chamberlain didn't have and that Shaquille O'Neal certainly doesn't have is what we call a low threshold. A threshold is a passage from one place to another place, a bridge. And a low threshold means it's easy to pass over to another place from where you are. A high threshold is the opposite. Now, you got guys in this congregation that will come up to this platform and they'll step from the ground up to here. that's too high a threshold for me. I don't do that one anymore. I use the lower threshold over here. But if your threshold is low, it's easier for you to manage it. If the only way to get up here is by this, some of us aren't going to make it. And here's the point. Rick Barry said, it's easy for me to get from here to where I want to be because it's about scoring. And I know I can score more points if I shoot granny style. So I don't care what people think about me and the way I look. I don't care that they chant, granny, granny, because I just smile at them and keep scoring points. And Shaquille O'Neal says, nope, too high a threshold. I'm not going up there. I'm going to stay down here and look cool and be one of the lousiest free throw shooters in the game. But I'm cool. Now, I'm going to tell you something, young people. You can have this high threshold in your life and say, I'm too cool for that. I don't want to follow Jesus if that's what it requires. You're telling me I've got to give up the way I talk, the way I dress. I got to dress different than the people of the world. I can't use the language that my friends use. I mean, I know it's filthy, but it's cool. Everybody does it. I can't tell the jokes they tell. I can't go to the movies they go to. I don't play the video games they play. I don't listen to the music that they listen to. You're telling me I can't do that? I don't want to live different than my friends. You got a high threshold and you'll not get to where Jesus is. But if your threshold's low, because you understand what the game's about, and I don't use that word game lightly here, but the purpose of life is living for God. And if you understand that, and that's the most important thing, and it overrides and trumps everything else, your threshold's low, and you'll do what's right, and you'll come out winning the salvation of your soul. Anything less than that low threshold, anything that keeps you from being the child of God you ought to be. And adults, that same thing is true for you. It goes for how you dress and where you go and what recreational things you engage in and what you spend your money on and what jokes you laugh at and what you're willing to do in the workplace to get ahead. If your desire to achieve success with Jesus Christ is more important than anything else, you'll put your lobe to the doorpost and let Jesus drive a cross through it. And you will be his bond slave for life. Because what he says is this: be holy. Be perfect. Follow me. Follow me. And that's the invitation tonight. Come, die with Jesus. Give your life up. Pin yourself to the door that he is. Let the threshold be so low that you have no trouble doing whatever he says and ignoring what the world thinks, because you know what the game's really about, the salvation of your soul. If that means something to you and you don't know what that entails in detail, let's talk about it. But if you're ready to give your life to Jesus Christ, if you're ready to confess him as the Lord of your life, if you're ready to turn away from what has kept you from that life, if you're ready tonight to be immersed in water, dying to yourself and committing yourself to dying daily, then I ask you to come to the front and give your life to Jesus. He says, follow me. While we stand and sing.